the rush is on for land, farmland. And those making the rush for farmland have pockets filled with cash, lots of cash. This land rush leads us to ask, who will be left on the land to tend the land?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1281st edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among a friend over there in Acadelia who are tuned into the podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, this from Pearl Buck's The Good Earth. It is the end of a family when they begin to sell their land. Out of the land we came, and into it we must go. And if you hold your land, you can live. Perhaps those rushing to buy up the world's farmland are doing so because they read The Good Earth, but one suspects not. The more likely reason is that they were rushing to buy up all that farmland is that they've been listening to some clever financial advisors. Look, a financial advisor might say, there is no better way to put your money, no better place to put your money than in good farmland. Unlike money that melts away like snow in spring, farmland is a tangible asset that holds its value. And like other tangible assets like gold, farmland pays dividends in the form of rents and crops. Those who have a lot of cash to invest listened and heard. Today, a small group of non-farming landlords control and rent out approximately 30% of all U.S. farmland. One of them, Bill Gates, owns 270,000 acres across 18 states. And as today's active farmers will retire out over the next decade or so, 400 million more acres of good farmland will likely go to those who have pockets filled with cash. Let us, for just a moment, take an imaginary walk down any street in any town, USA. Give a quick look at each home that we walk by. Is the home occupied by its owner or a renter? It's easy to see. Renters, because owners can't afford not to keep up their property, while renters can't afford to keep up the property of others. So you can see who owns or who's living in the house by what the property looks like. The fact that so much of our farmland is being taken up by those who do not farm or live there leads us to ask, who will be left on the land to tend the land? And who better to ask than Holly Rippon Butler, who is the land campaign director for the National Young Farmers Coalition. Holly, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yes, well, we are very grateful to hear that there is indeed a coalition of young farmers. Tell us a little bit about your organization.
Sure. So the National Young Farmers Coalition was founded in 2010 by young farmers who really came together actually originally around the challenge of access to land and recognizing that this was a shared experience and a shared challenge that they were facing, and understanding that it wasn't about something that they personally were doing wrong, but it was really a structural barrier and related to larger forces through, namely through federal policy. So Young Farmers Coalition was started to be an organization that represented and mobilized the voices of young farmers and ranchers across the country to affect policy change. And that's the work that we're doing. We have a number of young farmer-led chapters around the country, and we work to bring farmer voices into policy change at the state and federal level.
Mm-hmm. What kind of policy are you talking about, Holly? What federal policy do you see that's essentially like a big fence that won't let you in to land ownership?
Well, the history of federal policy as it relates to land is long and extremely complex and also extremely inequitable. A lot of our federal policy related to land has been used to explicitly prohibit ownership or discriminate against individuals who are not white. And that's really been in effect since the, you know, beginning of having a connection between the ability to vote and own land, and then the ability to hold public office being tied to owning land, and seeing policies since then really set up this structural barrier around who can own land. And we've seen that on a broad scale result in 98% of farmland is owned by white individuals, and the barriers are much higher for farmers of color who would like to get into farming and have secure land access. So that's one really big and important aspect of how our federal policy related to land impacts the ability to access land for young people in this country. But generally, the mechanisms that we're working with are around the Farm Bill primarily. It's our biggest piece of farm legislation, happens roughly every 5 years. And that's a place where we see a lot of opportunity to make change, although we're certainly doing work with elected officials and the administration in between and having lots of conversations.
Well, you know, the racial disparity of which you speak was certainly evident in 1889 with the Oklahoma land rush. In the fact that the federal government took away the land of the indigenous tribes of the Oklahoma Territory and gave them to whoever could get to the land first. And they had that spectacular land rush, 50,000 people running to get their 160 acres of land. And yet those that originally lived on the land were kind of put out to pasture, and so there they are, tough. There's a lot of money going after land these days. And I just wonder what happens to the tenure to the people on the land when they no longer own it.
Yes. So I think that it's really important in talking about land to think about what it actually means that is meaningful to farmers and to growers and people who want to steward the land. And in many cases, that is not even actually really focused on the concept of ownership. I talked to many young farmers and ranchers who would prefer to think of themselves as stewards of the land and to be in relationship with the land without involving that concept of ownership. I think, unfortunately, in order to have the security that growers need to invest in their farm businesses, to invest in climate resiliency and land management practices, often that translates into ownership in this current system of private property that we have and how land is managed and owned. And so because land ownership is so out of reach, that means that land security is so out of reach. And many young farmers are forced into situations where they're renting land and might not know how long they're able to stay or what they're going to be able to see in terms of long-term investments playing out on the land. And that's where it gets really challenging. So I think it is true that it's very challenging for young farmers to own land. And even if that's not necessarily what they would want, it does end up having to be kind of the goal in many ways, just to achieve the security that they need.
And if you're a renter, then it's really hard to, it's really difficult then to practice regenerative agriculture. How do you invest in building up the soil when you're just there as a temporary occupant? It makes it real difficult. And then following upon that notion, what is going to happen to our food if all the farmers end up becoming renters?
Yeah, I think that's those are the really important questions to be asking and to understand that those are the consequences of the direction that we're headed if we're not specifically making policies and being very intentional about making sure that it's the farmers and the growers who can have the security that they need on that land. And you really are headed in a direction where it's quite impossible and really truly unfair to ask a farmer to make investments in the soil through their labor as well as their monetary investments. And there's just the risk that they might take to have less income in the near term in order for longer term benefits for the land and their business. And you are headed exactly down a path where without security, we're going to see both a loss of farmers in the immediate sense and then also just this sort of longer term loss of knowledge on particular pieces of land. It can take so long, I mean, years, decades. You could spend a lifetime learning a piece of land and developing relationship with it. So to lose that opportunity, I think we lose a specific type of knowledge of stewardship as well.
So the issues are twofold then. One is that it appears as though this investment in farmland has really seemed to have taken off in the last decade or so. I think Bill Gates started buying his property in 2013, and now he owns, 270,000 acres? And other people are doing the same thing. I think Jeff Bezos is also in on the land rush as well, and many other people. Have you, as a young farmer, and representing young farmers, sat down and thought about farmland as an investment rather than as the good earth?
Yeah, I spend a lot of time thinking about what it means that it has become that for so many people, and I think about it from the perspective of how do we craft policies that can push back against that and try to help us think of land as more of a collective resource than a commodity. But I do, seeing those trends in many ways, it's easy to look at and say, yeah, I understand. That makes sense. If you are able to accumulate that many resources as the Jeff Bezoses and Bill Gates of the world have, you are probably looking at the current situation saying, yeah, we have a climate crisis. We have potential for food insecurity. We are looking at land as a good that really won't depreciate in value and is a very tangible asset to accumulate and resell. And so I think it's very alarming that logic you can understand and you can see how that makes sense. And I think what's alarming is that there are so little guardrails on that kind of thinking and from the public policy perspective.
Well, okay. That's something I'd like to pick up when we come back from this break. But I'd like to go through a couple of points with respect to farmland as an investment so that we can all see where this is going to take us, maybe. And hopefully Holly will have an answer because she is representing the land campaign for the National Young Farmers Coalition. We will be right back.
let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, we are back with Holly Ripon Butler, who is the land campaign director for the National Young Farmers Coalition. And isn't it nice to know that there are young farmers that are working together to figure out how to keep farming? Man, it's a pretty good deal if you ask me, because without them, there's no future. Because as Michael Olson's first law of the food chain goes, agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles. And if the farmers don't have the land, I don't know, where's it going to go? And if you stay tuned, we have some very interesting points with respect to Bill Gates as to the possible direction for food without farmland. So we are talking about farmland as an investment. And it is a tangible asset that holds its value. Now, money might be considered a tangible asset, but money has a way of melting away, like snow in spring. And whereas land holds on to its value. So that's a significant advantage for somebody with money to put in something. What can you put it into that will hold its value? There are a few things that I can see that hold its value. Gold has a way of holding its value, but gold does not pay dividends like farmland can. Farmland can pay you annual dividends in form of rents and crops. So it's something that holds its value, and it's something that keeps paying you. So it's a pretty good deal. As a consequence of that, you know, the National Council of Real Estate Investment Fiduciaries says that over the last 20 years, farmland has paid 12.5% dividends every year. So Holly, with farmland being such an attractive investment, how can you keep it from becoming consolidated in the hands of Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos?
Well, I think, yeah, this is exactly where public policy needs to come into play. I think these are large-scale trends that are not simply solvable by the open market and by private individuals. I think that's why we're so focused on policy change as a mechanism for keeping farmland as a public good and in available to people for growing food and feeding our communities. So I think, you know, on the broad scale, our answer lies in policy change. And in terms of the specifics, I think there are many ways. It won't be just one single policy or solution, but a suite of changes that need to be made to prioritize access to this resource for growers. And, you know, one of the ways that we've engaged in this in the past is working with the land conservation community and land trusts, mm-hmm. and making sure that their work is funded through our federal programs that support that kind of work, and basically also making sure that we're strengthening the programs. So when farmland is being protected from development, we're ensuring it's really protected for farmers and staying affordable to working farmers. We can make changes through the tax code, through incentivizing land transition to go to young and beginning farmers, to farmers of color. We can make changes through the capital gains tax, which has been in the news lately with some of the legislation being proposed by the Biden administration. I think looking at how capital gains taxes incentivize people currently to hold on to land until they pass away, we could make changes that would actually shift that incentive and encourage sales to young and beginning farmers, to farmers of color. So I think there's there's numerous ways to look at it. There's also really just making sure funding is available to support community-led initiatives. I think where we've seen so much positive change come around who has access to land and who can own land has been a lot of community-led organizations that are themselves buying and holding land and making it more cooperatively available to farmers. We've seen, you know, land banking efforts by municipalities to ensure that land remains affordable, and farm incubators where land, you know, might be available for young people as they're getting started to learn how to farm and establish their businesses. All of these things, I think, help work against some of these larger trends of farmland investment and help put it back in community control.
Well, may I ask you about how the Coalition for National Coalition for Young Farmers contends? You speak of the 5-year farm bill, so one assumes that that's when you go to Washington, D.C. and lobby for your cause. But what I've seen in watching Washington, D.C., is that people with all the cash are always there doling out the cash to protect their interests. And so I suspect, whereas, you know, when the coalition goes there once every 5 years to affect change in the farm bill, those people with a lot of cash, you know, have people that are in the offices all the time and taking lobbyists out to lunch and whatnot. So how do you overcome those economies of scale as young farmers? You know, it costs a lot of money just to buy a plane ticket to Washington, D.C. But if you have sufficient economies of scale, you can get in your Gulfstream and just zip up there, or you hire somebody to be there all the time. So how do you go about contending with that just raw fact of nature?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think, well, one aspect of it is that we do actually have someone, you know, in D.C. all the time. We have staff on the Hill, and that's part of what we are trying to bring to the conversation as a coalition, is working in partnership with a small but mighty number of other young, other organizations that are advocating and have been advocating on behalf of small farms and ranches and our, you know, food system for decades, and joining their voices on the Hill. So there are a number of us that, you know, have offices there and are regularly meeting with elected officials. But I think a larger part of the answer to that question of how you contend is our farmer network and the young farmers and ranchers across the country who are such a powerful piece of how we get the message across. And what we do is just try to help make sure that they're connecting with their elected officials. We help set up farm tours where those elected officials are meeting farmers on their farms and ranches. And we set up what we call just listening sessions or in-district meetings, where when elected officials are home, they're able to hear from a number of farmers. We do fly-ins, as you were talking about. We bring farmers to D.C. and are lucky to have funding for that as well. But I think it is, it's really about just the power of hearing farmers' voices directly and how that can really be so much more meaningful and really will stick with somebody. So it's about building those relationships over time, helping elected officials see these farmers as really trusted voices who they're listening to and responding to in their advocacy, and a force to be reckoned with, to understand that these are business owners in their districts. These are individuals who are very deeply connected and are creating jobs and are really part of climate solutions. And so I think it's holding up those farmers and ranchers and making those connections that really increases our reach.
Well, cooperatives have always served farmers as a way of generating economies of scale. You can be a small farmer, but if you cooperate with other small farmers, then you can gain the economies of scale to have an impact. You can buy stuff cheaper and develop markets and even, you know, take a congressman out to lunch and so on. So cooperating as you are doing would seem to be a good way to begin the fight. I would like to pick up Bill Gates, if I can, and use him as, I guess, a foil of sorts, to talk about what happens when somebody like Bill Gates buys 270,000 acres of farmland. What the heck does he do with it all? Have you looked into that? How do you farm 270,000 acres?
Yeah, well, NBC did some really interesting reporting on this recently, and really did take a close look at what is happening on those acres and how are they being managed. And so, yeah, I would encourage kind of looking at that, their findings. I think, you know, the answer is you have a management company or other individuals who you pay to help manage that land, and that the results are often a very impersonal and perhaps not, you know, specific to that piece of land kind of solution that can really create some problems down the line.
And you're probably looking at the land not as so much the good earth, but as an investment. And so you do those things that can generate the greatest return and the least amount of money. Now, one thing we know about Bill Gates is that he's been very active in pushing green revolution technology on the farmers of Africa, and to some very mixed results, to say the least. So we wonder what he has planned for all the farmland that he's buying up in America. Is it going to be to regenerate the soil, to improve the land? Is it going to be to develop new methods for high-tech agriculture? Just curious what Bill Gates has in mind. Now, Bill Gates also has other investments. When you have all that money, you have lots of investments. But some of his other investments have been directed into faux food, which is a nice way of saying fake food. For an example, he and Jeff Bezos just bought into Nature's Find, FYND. Nature's Find is a company that has developed a process to make faux foods out of fungus. And so I'm reaching here. We see in big investments in farmland and big investments in fake foods. So we're wondering, if you buy up all the farmland, get rid of the farms, get rid of the farmers, get rid of the crops, and sell people fake food. Could that be where Bill Gates is going? I don't know. What do you think is going to happen to our food, Holly?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that I won't speculate on, you know, exactly what Bill Gates has planned for, you know, his purchases or any of that. But I think it is really important to just center the conversation on the farmers and the individuals who have the knowledge of the land and how to grow. And that's what we're really focused on, is just how do we ensure that those people who are truly irreplaceable in their knowledge and in their expertise have the resources they need and have the support that they need and are really being being centered in the conversation. So I think that's where we focus and think it's really important to do our work.
But you almost, in helping your coalition of young farmers compete, you have to look at the competition. And, you know, my goodness, how many farmers could 279,000 acres support? Quite a few, one suspects. But those acres will not support young farmers. So don't you have to look at people who are amassing all of this land and say, how can we compete with them?
Yeah, certainly. I think, right, it's keeping an eye on what are these trends and who is able to access land and to amass it into these quantities. And just the fact that that's possible, that someone can own that many acres and can really accumulate it as a private individual, I think that's what's concerning, and certainly what we would like to see policies work to push back on, and to say that really land access and stewardship should be community-centered and focus on the growers. Mm-hmm.
So the competition really is not so much in the fields as who can grow the best food, but really who can control the most rules and regulations about how food is grown, where food is grown. And so that's a tough fight, because it takes place in a town where people wear suits and have ties and expensive lunches. But when we come back from this coming break, I'd like to discuss with Holly and you where all of this is taking us. Are you as paranoid as I am about the future of our food? We'll talk a little bit about that when we come back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What, with Holly Rippon Butler, Land Campaign Director, National Young Farmers Coalition. Right back.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Port Ideas, Greg Williams.
There's a tremendous amount of useful information in MetroFarm for farming in or near the city.
Acres USA's Charles Walters.
MetroFarm tells how to convert an opportunity into a real going concern. Every chapter is organized around the logic of practicality. For every problem needing a solution, MetroFarm offers a progression of steps arranged in sequence so the desired goal is achieved.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
When you buy local American-grown flowers, flowers will grow and flourish in America. Hello, I'm Deborah Prinzing, author of Slow Flowers for Certified American-Grown Flowers. When you buy local flowers, you're helping our country's family farms reduce the transportation footprint of flowers and enjoy fresher, longer-lasting bouquets. So please, next time you shop for flowers, think local. Think Certified American-Grown Flowers. Visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org to learn more.
Hi, folks. How many of you out there love to garden? Wouldn't it be nice to grow some of your own food? Or maybe a flower garden would brighten your day. Well, now you can have the pleasures of gardening without all that effort. You don't need a tractor. You don't need a rototiller. All you need is the Knox Garden Box, a heavily constructed, portable, elevated garden on legs that can virtually change the way you've gardened in the past. The Knox Garden Box can be set up anywhere. Yes, you can place it right on concrete. For those with bad backs, you've got critters and gophers, no space or maybe no dirt. With the Knox Garden Box, the therapy of garden is now the prescription for good mental health. The way to find your fabulous Knox Garden Box is by logging on to KnoxGardenBox.com. That's K-N-O-X, GardenBox.com. Or by calling 831-461-9430.
Business owners, get money you need in 2 to 3 days at businessmoneytogo.com. Business Money To Go is a network of reputable small business lenders that compete to lend you money. When you qualify with a one-page application, Business Money To Go will get you the best loan at the best rate in 2 to 3 days. Get $5,000 to $500,000 in 2 to 3 days at businessmoneytogo.com. businessmoneytogo.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it. On the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, in the opening to this show, I suggested a little exercise by which we walk down the street of any town in any state in pretty much any country in the world, and look at the houses as we walk by them. I suggest it would be pretty easy to see who lives in that house, whether it's the owner or the renter. Now, if you own the house, chances are pretty good you're going to keep it up because it's your investment. It's probably your biggest investment. So you're going to work and you're going to mow the lawn and prune the trees and take care of, paint the house. You're going to do what you can when you can to keep up your home. But if you're a renter, you can't really afford to do that because then you're investing in somebody else's territory, property. You know, why cut the lawn? It's not your lawn. So it's pretty easy to see whether it's an owner or a renter living in a house. Now, does that have any application to farming and agriculture? I suggest it does. Holly, am I on the right track?
Yeah, I think that's exactly the challenge, is that when you are working within a system that really bases your ability to build equity and save for the future around reselling a property, that creates a lot of challenges in the current, like how do you prioritize the ability to make any investments there when you don't have that long-term ability to recoup those or have even just the security to see them through. So, you know, for farmers, I think it's certainly right. It's not a lack of desire to steward the land or to implement practices. And in fact, is why we see so many young people leave farming, is just the continued frustration of not being able to make those kind of long-term investments because they are forced into leasing arrangements.
Mm-hmm. Well, over the years, I've worked with a lot of farmers in metropolitan areas, and it's almost impossible for them to own land because the closer you get to the inner city of a city, the higher the property values are. And so if you're even farming in the periphery of a metropolitan area, property values are going to be pretty high. But there's a lot of property available if you can work out a good lease or rent. It's almost impossible to rent. You have to have a lease. So you have to have some control over that property. Have you ever looked at how to help young farmers gain control of property without having necessarily to buy it?
Yeah, I think that's where a lot of our work with the land conservation community has come in. We land trusts and, you know, community land trusts are a model that have been around for a long time and have a lot of deep roots in affordable housing as well. But we've seen, you know, some exciting application of that idea to farmland access. And in particular, there's a model called the ground lease that I think is very exciting because it can bring together aspects of long-term security in access to the land without necessarily having to have ownership. So the idea is that the land trust or community-based organization would own the land and provide a long-term, very secure lease to the farmer in some states that can be as long as 99 years and inheritable and really function in a lot of ways like the security of ownership. But the farmer is just having that lease on the land, and then they actually have the opportunity to own the infrastructure on the land. So it's sort of splitting up who has ownership of what pieces of the land, but makes that the most expensive part, which will be the land itself, something that the farmer doesn't have to invest in and own right up front. They can, as they're trying to invest in their business, they have the opportunity to have a lease on that.
Who then owns the land?
That would be like the a community land trust or other local nonprofit okay. organization.
So then the land trusts are probably nonprofit organizations. Where do they get their money to buy land?
Land trusts are funded in a number of different ways. Many of them are community-based, so they're funded through membership or local fundraising. But we also have been, over a number of years, alongside other organizations like American Farmland Trust, doing a lot of federal policy advocacy to make sure that the programs that we do have at the federal level that will provide support to land trusts for their work stay funded and also are flexible and are really working for land trusts that want to try these new tools and sort of push the boundary of what it is that land trusts can do to help farmers have long-term security on the land.
Mm-hmm. A viable opportunity then.
And many states have farmland protection funding programs as well. So there's a lot of opportunity at the state level to advocate around this.
Okay. And when it gets right down to it, land trusts then, when you take land out of the private marketplace and put it into a public trust, that would probably serve to increase the value of the property that is for sale, would it not?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting point. I think it could work both ways. Certainly, it's not happening yet like at a scale where I would say it's really in any way the driving factor of scarcity of farmland availability. It's really much more just trying to help create models where land is actually available at its value for farming and for agriculture and the value that farmers could pay for it. So really what's driving land prices in a lot of places is purchases by people who are not farmers, who aren't dependent on a farming business plan to secure a mortgage or to offer cash for the property. So any kind of opportunity like land trust ownership of the land or these models, I think really do more to drive the market kind of in the other direction by putting some properties, making properties available that are at their agricultural value.
Yeah. If one has to rent land and pay its speculative costs, it probably would be almost impossible to farm. But if one could rent it as a piece of business infrastructure of a farm, probably possible then. So farm or land trusts make that possible then, correct?
Yeah, exactly. That's one of sort of the best case scenario, the ways that they can be really helpful.
Well, Holly, we have a few minutes left. And in that time, I'd like to offer you the opportunity to take every one of your young farmers throughout the nation and march them right into Washington, D.C., and to put a demand on the table. What would it be?
This is what
you want more than anything.
That's what we're really thinking about right now as we're headed up on the 2023 Farm Bill. And I think the demand is really that we want to see farmers' voices matter. We want to see land access and land transition at the center of the conversation. We want to see that be understood as foundational to solving so many of the other challenges that our country is grappling with right now. We want to see more equity in who has access to land and justice related to land access. And that, you know, those demands are really broad, but I think translate into specifics as we start working on the Farm Bill and as we're asking for really like specific policy changes. But I think that the message is really that we want to see Congress make a massive investment in land access and land transition for the next generation of farmers.
I've often thought that the greatest tragedy in the modern world is taking people off the farm and putting them on a street corner with nothing to do of note. And that's a recipe for trouble. And we've got a lot of trouble because there's not many people working on farms anymore. How can you get people back on the farms?
Well, yeah, I think this, you know, really
how
goes
can you
back.
Put them back to work? How can you put an implement in their hands and fire them up so that they're rebuilding the soil, so that they're growing food, so that we don't have to eat any of Bill Gates' faux fungus burgers?
I think that, like I said, you know, this is really goes back to the legacy of policy action that we have in this country that has deliberately removed people from the land. And I would say, you know, it's about really grappling with that, addressing it, acknowledging it, and saying that understanding that land has such a cumulative benefit and access to it has such cumulative impact, really, of who has the resources to self-determine how they want their relationship with the land to look and the resources that they have to grow food and have access to food sovereignty. And so I think, you know, it is about understanding that history, making policies that really grapple with that and say we need to put land and access to the accumulated wealth that comes from land back into the hands of the farmers and ranchers of color and who we've taken it away from through a policy. And I think it's letting those individuals determine how they want their relationship with the land to look. That is most important, but that we can really must make those changes through policy and acknowledge the role that policy has played to date. That it is really land is such a center of the ability to have self-determination and resources. And so I think it's really critical to consider it part of where we're headed.
Well, I'm happy that there are people like you who are willing to fight it out on the policy front. I guess I get pretty skeptical about policy because I see the impact of that money has on policymakers, as I mentioned earlier in the show. So what I see happening with policy is that, you know, I think a good example of that, Holly, is what happened to organic agriculture. In the beginning, young farmers wanted to set this word aside, organic, as a way of denoting a very special way of farming and growing food that was focused on the soil and the life of the soil and without using, you know, toxic substances to do so. And so what they did is they went to Washington, D.C. and gave their word to the federal government. And now organic can be just about anything. It can organic food can be grown in water. So I see what happened to that word organic and how it was literally taken out of the hands of small farmers, of young farmers, and taken over. So how do I get some of your enthusiasm for policy? Where do I go to get some?
Oh, yeah, you've got to meet the young farmers who we get to work with every day, who really, and to see the real change that happens. You know, I've been in numerous meetings where young farmers have traveled to Washington, D.C. or had elected officials out to their farm, and by hearing them tell their stories, it's really made an impact and made a change. And when we have, you know, people in the administration who are just really eager to meet with us and want to, they're problem solvers. And I think that that's the story of government that's often overshadowed by a lot of the arguing and the challenges that come with policy change. But there are, you know, there are real people in these offices and on the Hill, and they are in those positions largely because they like to solve problems and they want to listen to people who are bringing solutions to the table and do what they can with that. And I think that's where I get hope from that, is in the conversations with those people and watching them listen, truly listen to farmers, and really just watching a Congress member sit down with a farmer and give them their full undivided attention and take notes. And, you know, I've seen that numerous times, and I think that really gives me a lot of hope.
Well, and your hope gives me hope, and it's a good feeling to have hope. So who, my question, Holly, is who will be left on the land to tend the land? Is it going to be your young farmers?
If we don't, yeah, if we don't take action on policy?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's the question that drives our work, and we really believe in the people and the young farmers, and that their knowledge is really important and worth really fighting for. So
Holly's fighting, and we're hoping. Holly Rippon-Butler, Land Campaign Director, National Young Farmers Coalition. Easy to look up, easy to find, easy to help out. Thanks, Holly.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.